So to the upcoming one-year anniversary of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, in a moment we'll meet Teela Reid, a lawyer, a Wiradjuri and Wailwan woman who was born in Gilgandra, and also Danny Gilbert. He's a lawyer too. He's managing partner of Gilbert and Tobin, the corporate law firm he co-founded 3 decades ago, and he's also co-chair of the Cape York Partnership Group. But first, let's go back and hear how the Uluru Statement came about and what happened next.
More than 250 Indigenous leaders from around the nation will gather here this week to discuss what some believe is unfinished business, changing the Constitution to recognise this nation's first Australians.
Indigenous leaders and First Nation representatives from very diverse communities in the desert, Torres Strait, the major capital centres. There's a great deal of interest and engagement in the opportunity of constitutional recognition.
With Uluru gleaming behind them, island people from the Torres Strait danced on desert country. The Anangu traditional owners invited dozens of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations onto their land.
Welcome for everybody.
The council's starting point is what is the minimum that's acceptable to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. That's our starting point.
It's referendum council co-chairman Mark Liebler.
But at the end of the day, we also have to get the politicians on side, because without the politicians on side, you don't have a referendum.
At Uluru, delegates at the National Constitutional Convention are at a crucial point of talks to formulate a new position on a possible referendum model. Tomorrow, the delegates will make their view known.
Noel Pearson, thank you for joining AM this morning. How will history be made today?
We're presenting a draft statement from the centre. It is a statement that captures a series of 12 dialogues that have gone on for the last 5 months from all points of the compass in Australia.
Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished, and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood.
A major summit has ended in Uluru, with Indigenous leaders calling for a new representative body and a commission to oversee the creation of a treaty between the Commonwealth and the First Australians.
People want a treaty. They don't want acknowledgement, they want treaty, and they want truth, a truth and justice commission.
There is euphoria, I guess, because people realise that we have an opportunity.
The exciting part of this is being hopefully a part of history.
Indigenous hopes for a constitutionally enshrined body to advise federal parliament have been dashed by the Turnbull government. The Prime Minister and his cabinet have rejected holding a referendum on the plan. Well, Ken Wyatt is the Federal Minister for Aged Care and Indigenous Health.
In my discussions with the Prime Minister, his concern is that if you take this to a referendum, then it fails. But he also expresses a view that having another chamber is not within the remit of the thinking of the federal government.
I think Malcolm Turnbull has broken the First Nations hearts of this country, expressed in the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Malcolm Turnbull has not had the decency to put the proposition that Indigenous people have a voice to the Parliament, not a voice in the Parliament, a voice to the Parliament. Why not just put it to the Australian people?
Our view, the government's view, is that that is not a model that is desirable. This would is contrary to the principles of equality of citizenship in Australia, and moreover, it would have, in our judgment, no prospect at all of being successful in a referendum.
story of the Uluru Statement from the Heart and some of the voices that we've heard 1 year since it was created. What happened a year ago this Saturday at Uluru? And what do we make of what's happened since? Teela Reid is a Wiradjuri and Wailwan woman. She was raised in Gilgandra in the central west of New South Wales. She's a lawyer and she's previously been a delegate to the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Welcome this morning, Teela.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Danny Gilbert. He's a managing partner of Gilbert and Tobin, a high-powered corporate law firm he founded 3 decades ago. He's publicly called on both Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and opposition leader Bill Shorten to back the introduction of that parliamentary advisory body of First Australians. Welcome, Danny.
Thank you, Cassie.
Now, first to you, Teela. It's been said that the Uluru Statement was a First Nations gift to Australia. Tell us about that, what took place at Murujulu and how it came to create a document.
Yeah, so at Murujulu, really, it was a forum that endorsed a series of dialogues before it. So Prime Minister Turnbull and the Leader of the Opposition created what we know is as the Referendum Council. They were tasked to ask directly First Nations people how they seek to be recognised. The council travelled around the country and conducted dialogues seeking to ask First Nations people what form of recognition they would like to be recognised as in the Constitution. And this was an unprecedented process in the sense that the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition backed these dialogues. They allowed for the Referendum Council to go out into community with 5 models of how recognition might look like. And what happened at Murujulu at the National Convention was that convention endorsed a First Nations voice to Parliament. With respect to the dialogues themselves, we should be really proud as Australians of achieving that process. The proportion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who were engaged in that process is higher than the proportion of general Australians when the Constitution itself first came into force. And essentially what came out of Murujulu was that First Nations people endorsed reform, firstly in the form of a First Nations voice to Parliament and a Makarrata Commission to supervise both treaty and truth-telling processes across the country.
Mm. And this wasn't easy to do. There were people there from right around the country in the central desert, saltwater people from up north and people from all states and territories getting there. It took 3 days, I understand,
yes,
to kind of come to this agreement.
It was a profound achievement in the sense that there was consensus among 250 delegates to the Uluru Convention. And prior to that, the context is there were the debates within the dialogues which were robust, which really debated whether or not should we settle for symbolic recognition in the form of a statement or a preamble in the Constitution, or are there other substantive ways that we can be recognised that the Australian people will support at a referendum. And being First Nations people, we understand the impact of the laws, and we knew that this is an opportunity for structural reform. Symbolic recognition was rejected, and symbolic recognition includes a preamble and any tinkering with what we know as the race power. So that was why a First Nations voice to Parliament was proposed and gifted to the Australian people through the Uluru Statement from the Heart.
Mm. And the final part of the negotiations went into the night and people were singing outside the room where the dialogue was going on to kind of try and help the process reach its conclusion. The next day, the statement was read at sunset, and that was a significant day too, because I think as the sun went down, that marked 50 years since the 1967 referendum.
That's so correct. Yes, so it was read on the 50th anniversary of the achievement of the 1967 referendum, and we know that the Australian people do support First Nations reform and voicing the Constitution, because the 1967 referendum was the most successful referendum in Australian history. We know 90.77% of Australians voted yes to supporting First Nations people, and we know that there is goodwill in supporting the Uluru Statement from the Heart. We need our politicians now to show some leadership and move us forward on this structural reform.
So a deeply symbolic and spiritual document, in a way, that the Makarrata element that you referred to, being a very spiritual understanding of the Yolngu people about coming together after a dispute of some kind.
That's correct.
And you know, a big meaningful part of the statement. Danny Gilbert, after this proposal and statement was released into the public, you were very strong in your backing of it, and you said you called on Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten not to engage in legal nitpicking and in national hand-wringing, and let's work to make it work, you said. Why do you think, why have you personally chosen to back it so strongly?
Cassie, for me there are three reasons. If you think about it, Australia's Indigenous people lived on this land of ours for some 65,000 years. They had a strong culture, a strong identity, and they lived very successful, different but very successful lives here. The settlers come from the United Kingdom, and over the following 200 years they are dislodged, they are denied their lands, they die, they moved on to missions, they starve, they're hunted, they're murdered. They're nobody, really. And so I think that it is just unacceptable that our founding document, the rule book, if you like, contains no recognition of Australia's Indigenous people, except in very negative ways. And that history, their cultures, their languages, who they were, is deserved of recognition in our national document. That's my first point. Simply because who they were, simply because the fact that they lived and thrived here for 65,000 years, it is unacceptable that there should be no recognition of that in our founding document. Secondly, when we set up the Constitution in 1901, Indigenous people were mentioned, but they were not recognised, and they were mentioned in a negative way. The Commonwealth was given the power to make laws for any race, but the Aboriginal people were deliberately and specifically excluded. The Constitution also provided that in counting the number of people in Australia, Indigenous people were not to be counted, and at that time I think the common view was that they would die out. And so we then, 67 years later, we amend the Constitution to reverse that position and give the Commonwealth the power to make laws for Indigenous people. But not at any time, not in 1901, not in 1967, did we give them any guarantee of recognition. Any recognition of who they were as unique Australians. No recognition of their cultures, their languages, their connections to land, and indeed what they manifestly have to contribute to this nation of ours. And so my second reason is to correct the barefaced wrongs of the 1901 Constitution and the inadequate amendments that we put through and agreed as a nation in 1967. So, constitutional correction there, and I agree with what Taylor says, it cannot be symbolic. It must be substantive, and it must be structural. Why must it be structural? Because, we spend something like $34 billion on Indigenous Australians every year. Now, a lot of that is the same money, similar money that's spent on other Australians, but $6 or $7 billion of it's exclusively for Indigenous people. Every state and territory has a Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. They have large bureaucracies. No other group in Australia has so many people formulating policy, directives and laws which dictate and inform how Indigenous people should live their lives. They have no structural say in that at all. Sure, they have access to Parliament and they can see ministers, etc. And sometimes they'll be heard, sometimes they won't. But there's no other group of Australians with such massive and impenetrable bureaucracies governing their lives. We have to correct that. Policies in the past have failed. We have to somehow guarantee a better and more meaningful voice for Indigenous Australians about the very issues that are touched their lives, their cultures and their future existence and the role that they're going to play in this nation of ours. So I look at those for those three reasons.
Mm. We're talking with Danny Gilbert. He's a managing partner of the corporate law firm Gilbert and Tobin, and he's also co-chair of the Cape York Partnership Group and has made some very public statements supporting the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which is going to be 1 year old this Saturday. Also with us is Teela Reid, who's a Wiradjuri and Wailwan woman and also a lawyer, and she's been involved closely in the debate and the discussion around this. Now, Teela, what Danny said is both very personal and passionate, but also very clear, dry legal argument from your experience, Danny, years in the law. You know, it's clear that this is just a lay-down misere in some ways. Teela, can you explain to us how the First Nations voice advising Parliament would work? Because this has been the sticking point for some people, including the Prime Minister.
Well, in terms of how it would work, it would mean we would have a greater say in those policies and that bureaucratic process that Danny explained. The issue is, you know, we're quite frustrated with the wasting of taxpayers' money as well, with all of this bureaucratic red tape. At the end of the day, we have experienced both positive and negative policies, and we would like to have a say in terms of what they look like. With respect to what the structure and the functions of a First Nations voice to Parliament, it really is up to Parliament now to re-engage with First Nations people around that process, because at the end of last year we did see the Prime Minister dismiss that from what he characterised as a third chamber, and that is a really dishonest representation.
Yeah, what he said is that inevitably it would be seen as a third chamber to the federal parliament after the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Mm.
And he didn't actually say that he thought it was would be that, but he thought it would be seen as that. It's a distinction, I suppose, a fine one. But what does the actual statement say? Is it actually a proposed
Well, it's a voice to Parliament, not a voice in Parliament, and that is a distinction, because it must be democratically consistent with the Constitution that we have. And in that sense, what the Parliament need to do is to re-engage with First Nations people with that design. The dialogues understood when they debated about the models. They understood that with respect to the structure and the reform, that it would be guaranteed by the Constitution, but ultimately the detail must be set out in legislation. That means that Parliament must pass it, and therefore it can't be considered a third chamber because it's entirely consistent with the democratic process, with Parliament passing laws.
Mm. Danny, people have said there's no other group that would be represented in this way. The counter-argument I've heard is that there's no other group that's actually named in the Constitution in this way, and so that's irrelevant.
Well, there is no other group named in the Constitution except, as I said earlier, to go back to 1901, Indigenous people were named, but in a negative way. And I think that Indigenous people are not like any other people. They are the descendants of people who lived here for 65,000 years. No other group of people has bureaucracies and ministers deciding things about their lives. So they are quite different from any other group in this country. It needs to be looked at historically about who they are, where they come from, how they've been treated, how we've engaged with them. And you can distinguish Indigenous people quite simply, in my view, from any other group, ethnic or otherwise, in the country. And, you know, Taylor has already said, I mean, the Prime Minister's objection that the body would become some third chamber of Parliament ignores its strictly advisory role. It will do no damage to the parliamentary system, no damage to our Westminster system, no damage to our constitution. Indeed, the amendments that are proposed in every way uphold our constitution. And
you've written that it will simply give Indigenous Australians a voice and a place at the table, and we have nothing to fear here.
Nothing to fear whatsoever.
Mm.
And we owe it to them. For once in 230 years, let's give them what they ask for.
And just to add to what Danny's saying, this idea of a First Nations advice to Parliament is entirely consistent with the current Prime Minister's approach to Indigenous policy. He himself has his own Indigenous Advisory Council. First Nations people are simply asking for our voice to be guaranteed within the Constitution. So it is by no means undemocratic to propose a voice to Parliament, and it is entirely consistent with our current processes.
Now, part of this would involve going to the public, taking a referendum to a public vote. What is the risk involved with that? What if it was knocked back in the form? Would it create a rift? We've seen Malcolm Turnbull bruised and battered from his experience of having a failed referendum. His was on the Republic. What do you think? Would it set things back 20 years?
Well, I think particularly over the past year, since the Uluru Statement was gifted to the Australian people, there has been growing consensus and growing momentum in support of a constitutionally First Nations enshrined voice. I personally think with the right leadership, we will see a referendum get up and be successful. Obviously, there is a risk involved, and our mob are not, we're used to being knocked back at different points in time. All of our advocacy has come from pragmatism, pushing ideas forward and often getting rejected, or we keep pursuing and we don't give up. Whether or not the referendum does get up and fail, I don't think it will, but it will still be a pivotal moment in our history.
I think Taylor has put that very well.
You think it doesn't matter whether the outcome is successful or not? It's important just to
go. It matters a lot whether it's successful or not, but we shouldn't think it won't be successful. The Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition get behind it with the right process, with the right advocacy. I agree with Taylor. It can be successful, and it's worth the risk.
Mm.
And so if we go forward and it loses, Indigenous people are resilient. As Taylor says, they've been knocked back before, they will come again. It's like the Republic debate. The Republic was lost, but it will come. Everybody concedes that one day we will be a Republic, one day we will have proper constitutional recognition of our Indigenous people, and they will rally again, and people like me will rally to support them.
Yes, and I guess part of what you've been doing is trying to engage the top end of town where you work in this project. How's that going?
Very well. I think there is a lot of support in Indigenous Australia to correct the wrongs of the past and to bring Indigenous people to the table of opportunity in Australia. In education, in employment, in wealth creation, there is a lot of thinking going on, a strong recognition that the wrongs of the past need to be corrected for the benefit of Indigenous people, but for the benefit of all Australians, not just Indigenous. This is not just about Indigenous Australians. This is about making Australia a better place for everybody.
You're nodding, Taylor.
Yes, and I agree with Danny on that point. It is a nation-building exercise, and also, it's not up to the Prime Minister to say it will fail. It's up to the Prime Minister to show some leadership and put it to the people. So I think once we get to that point, we do have momentum now, and we will see it come to fruition.
So from that exhilaration a year ago to the disappointment at the end of last year, mm-hmm. when the ideas were knocked back, essentially, by the government. What now? What does the Aboriginal and Torres... I mean, I don't want to make you the voice of the entire Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations, but is there a sense of defeat or going forward?
No, there's absolutely a sense of going forward. And as Danny said, not just for First Nations people. This is about every single Australian. And there is a real movement of the Australian people accepting the gift of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, because they want the acknowledgement of the history, of the great history we have with our cultures and our languages, and access to that beautiful world. So I absolutely think there's only growing momentum right now. We need the leadership.
Mm. Well, you both have clearly displayed that this morning. Thank you for explaining your position so clearly for us, and from different ends of town as well. Yeah, it's been wonderful to speak to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cassie.
Teela Reid is a lawyer, an Indigenous advocate, and a Wiradjuri and Wailwan woman who was raised in central western New South Wales in Gilgandra. And Danny Gilbert is a managing partner of Gilbert and Tobin, one of the big corporate law firms in town. 3 decades ago, he co-founded it. He's also the co-chair of the Cape York Partnership Group, and the two of them giving us their different perspectives on the same thing about the Uluru Statement from the Heart, the declaration that was given to Australia by the First Nations people almost 1 year ago. It'll be 1 year on Saturday.
As a young boy...